Good morning. This is Dr. Dan Guerra, and you are listening to Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today is the second day of July 2022. We were discussing a paper published a few years back on the utilization of icosapentaenoic and docosahexaenoic acid in macrophage cell culture. And the reason I've been discussing it is because it has direct impact on the larger lecture we're trying to cover, which is membrane biochemistry. And that, of course, requires we spend a fair amount of time talking about lipids. And I wanted to give you a really good in-depth understanding of how significant it is to have these unique, very long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids of the omega-3 series in certain biological membranes. I've emphasized often the central nervous system, but I've also probably spent 30 hours of lecture on the immune system on authentic biochemistry, discussing how lipids play a significant role in immune responses, writ large. And I've also talked very specifically about certain molecular species of lipids and the role they play, for example, in the activation or in the transformation of T cell lineages. We've also discussed macrophages, both M1, M2. M1 is going to be a proactive, pro-inflammatory macrophage lineage, and M2 is going to be a regulatory macrophage. I told you about the switching of that, the transcription factors involved in that in previous lectures. So what I'm going to do today is fuse some of that earlier material with this paper we've been discussing about EPA and DHA in membranes, and come up hopefully with a synthesis by the end of this half hour. And then, of course, it's going to probably take two more lectures to finish this arc of the lecture before we get back into complex lipids. Basically, we're still talking only about the fatty acids that are found within the complex lipids, okay? And again, the reason we're getting into this very fine molecularity is you need to understand the biochemical system is hundreds and hundreds of millions of interactions occurring simultaneously in any given cell. And so we can talk about only 20 or 30,000 different proteins, and we can talk about 20 different amino acids and 100 different carbohydrates, and maybe only 30 or 40 different fatty acids and prenolipids. But understand, when you start assembling macromolecules, so DNA is just a polymer of nucleic acids. RNA is just a polymer of nucleic acids. Protein is a polymer of amino acids. But with membranes, which I have argued are another macromolecular structure, quite heterogeneous, doesn't just have lipids, but also has carbohydrate, nucleic acid, and of course, polypeptide. But that membrane is a coherent unit. And if we start thinking about how the membrane is communicating regularly with endomembranous systems, as well as the cytoplasm, involving things like gene expression and bioenergetics and signaling, at the same time, especially the plasma membrane, being right there at the surface of the cell, and also because of the inner leaflet interacting directly with the cytoplasmic compartment, but also with the whole Golgi apparatus, which is associated with the endoplasmic reticulum, the mitochondrion, as well as the peroxisomal activities and the nuclear activities, that you have a continuation of molecular events that are occurring across that membrane. And again, the sum total of that is going to be in the hundreds of billions total of different interactions happening. When you think about all the different molecules that are running through, for example, various metabolic pathways and turning over. And that's not an estimate that I just pull out of the air. When you do calculations on how many different reactants are converted to products in the multiply integrated biochemical pathways we talk about in general biochemistry, and then you think about and not just think, but you organize your thoughts around where the products of those reactions can end up, ultimately integrated into other pathways. And then at the same time, having a conversion of macromolecular structures to their monomeric units. And during that process, inducing another series of metabolic pathways that could relate to cell fate. For example, I'm thinking about autophagy or mitophagy or peroxisomophagy. During the normal activity of a cell, even before cell division, right? You can come up to numbers of interactions that are individual molecular events, conversions, if you want to call them that, that run into several, hundreds of millions happening simultaneously, because we have to think about the molar concentration of all the intermediates there. So that's what I'm getting down to, the actual number of conversions of individual molecules, right? And then you amplify that with an understanding that in a living system that's constantly integrated into the network, if it's an animal system, the entire homeostasis of that organism is more or less still dependent on what's going on at each cellular level. You can easily get to numbers into the billions. And then if you add into that all of the environmental interactions that occur, which of course are constantly happening. Think about the diet. Think about atmospheric conditions, temperature, gases, heat exchange, and then the mobility and the interactions of the human body during the waking day, or even when you're sleeping, the solidification of memories in the central nervous system. So there's a whole tremendous amount of biochemical activity even during the sleeping hours, that is then amplified when one is awake because the awareness mode is on. And so all the experiences have to be processed in real time. Again, you're thinking of, we're talking about hundreds of billions of interactive events happening simultaneously at the level of seconds, not minutes. So we can't obviously organize all that into some grand map and say, here is metabolism, even in one cell, right? A normal, let's say a hepatocyte, because it would be the type of map that would need to be plastered on the side of Pike's Peak. And because of the dimensions of it, you'd never be able to see any, you'd never be able to get to a point where you could observe the entire thing. Right? It would be too large to observe it. And you would need a magnifying glass if it was put on a smaller scale. And so we never do that. But if we did add everything together, that's the kind of the scope of the grand response that's occurring in cellular phenomena. So I emphasize this in authentic biochemistry, like I emphasized it in my years teaching in the classroom and in lecture halls, because when you hear of something like, well, here's a specific gene, and this gene gives a gene product, and that gene product is what we're trying to isolate out and try to modify because we think it's associated with, let's say, hepatocellular carcinoma. And then we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of published papers on that one molecule interaction. Let's say it's a programmed death receptor system, right? The PDL system that triggers responses in T cells, right? And if the ligand binds to the programmed death receptor, you get T cells which are shut down, right? In fact, ultimately can go through an apoptotic event. And that if we could corrupt that inappropriate programmed death by inhibiting the ligand being synthesized from a tumor, or inhibiting the ligand from binding to the receptor. And this is now, we're talking about immunobiochemical therapy in oncogenesis, in tumor biology, and in frank diseases of cancer. You might think that, oh, well, we're really, really getting down to understanding cancer because we're looking at the programmed death system. okay, or the CTL4 system. Keep in mind, that's only one molecule. And even though it's interacting with a few other molecules I just mentioned to you, like receptors, think of all the bioenergetics involved. Think about all the other cellular events that are involved. And we talked about this when I went to depth in those programmed death systems. This was quite a while ago in lecture on the podcast. And then pull out of that and realize that just targeting that one system is going to change the entire system, because the entire system isn't substance-based, it's event-based, which means time is always the signature of the living system, right? It's a change in concentration of all these potential intermediates and pathways over time. And the change is not linear. That is, each one of those transformations has a different temporal signature. And even that association with a given molecule and its turnover in the cell, let's say a protein, also is not consistent. The turnover isn't uniform. It is always being amplified and being diminished by the interactions of all the other occurrences in the cell, such that there's no way to even program an understanding, right? To come up with a projection of when you turn the cell on, how those events are going to go down. All you can do is make tremendous abstractions, right? Tremendous inductions of the given information you already have about a given system, say programmed death. And all those inductions require assumptions. And those assumptions are based on specific events, but the events themselves are constantly changing and moving forward. They're not cycling back, even though we have pathways that look like they could be turned around, or enzymatic reactions that could be reversed because of thermodynamic considerations. That's not a cycle, because the whole event is occurring as time is continually moving forward, and the cell is aging, and the system is aging within an environment that's constantly changing. Right? And life, again, continues along this way. It's not a cyclical event. It is always changing and moving forward from the moment, if you're talking about a human being, the conception of that human being to his death. And so each individual that has all of these interacting phenomena, hundreds of billions of events, is not a phenomena that you can describe once and say that static event describes it, because it itself is constantly changing. So can we understand all of that in one composite description? My argument is no. We can explain the mechanisms. We can explain the hierarchy. We can go to the discrete level of products going on to produce new substrates for new pathways. We can talk about complete oxidation or partial oxidation or complete reduction. Or we can talk about transition states. We can talk about repealing ferritosis or necrotosis. We can talk about sarcopenia in muscles as people age. But we cannot give any picture that isn't a moving picture. And that moving picture would never explain even, you know, the smallest fraction you can imagine of what's really occurring there. And that is authentic biochemistry. That's what's really happening. So it never surprises me when a new pharmaceutical comes on the market. It's touted as being really useful, for example, for cardiovascular disease. And it will modify, let's say, hypertrophy in the cardiac muscle in such a way as to diminish the amount of fibrosis, or maybe decrease the ability of that new system to receive blood flow, right? So we talk about hematopoiesis, and we talk about cell differentiation, and we think about what are the transcription factors involved in those phenomena, and can we slow that down to decrease hypertrophy in the aging heart so we can decrease heart failure. And all the papers, and we've talked about these in a lecture, and some of them fantastically good work, right? Understand that those are just pinpricks in the sky, and the sky is the universe, and the universe is what's going on in the living system. It might as well be, right? And it is indeed just how we understand the space-time continuum. Now, I often hear non-scientists say that, well, you know, dealing with Euclidean geometry and the fact that, you know, the fifth postulate in Euclidean geometry is the fact that two parallel lines never meet, but that to understand very, very large expanses, such as the universe, we have to agree that space and time aren't two separate phenomena. And of course, both of those are not phenomena that are real phenomena. Those are placeholders for phenomena that we're trying to describe and map out geometrically, arithmetically, algebraically. But those aren't real things. You can't say, here is space, right? Space is a concept. Time is a concept that helps us understand phenomena that exist in nature, right? So with all that in mind, people will often say, well, because non-Euclidean geometry says that no parallel lines can meet, and we have to describe that because that's how space and time, because of gravity, seem to be able to curve around to make a universe. So there's no such thing as empty space. There's only space-time, and you can't talk about space-time unless there's something happening, and that's the event ontology. That very large scale, this is why I'm bringing all this up, saying non-scientists bring this up and say that we have to have space-time for large-scale events. My argument has always been we have to have space-time for very, 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 very small microscopic, nanoscopic events, because all the way from the picoscopic to the macroscopic of the universe, each one of those levels of hierarchy are space-time events. And the quantum mechanics of it is there if you look for it, right? There are quantum events in cellular biology, but the measurement of it is so out of focus that we have to describe it as something like glucose to glucose 6-phosphate, right? And even we talk about sigma orbitals and pi orbitals around given bonding patterns. Again, that's like looking at events occurring in molasses, right? We don't have the kind of detailed understanding or even the descriptors to get into the quantum effects inside cells. Yet that's what's really going on. And the theories of relativity, which Einstein got, I would say, from Immanuel Kant, his understanding, basically, his epistemology, Kant's epistemology, and then later on, some of his metaphysics, that's where Einstein got the idea of relativity. It's clear to me. Einstein was thinking, again, about making mathematical models of large-scale events, such as, movements of the planets, for example, and trying to make a better description of what Newton left us with and what Galileo had provided a lot of evidence for, as an example, lots of other scientists too. And he did. Einstein was able to take the epistemology and metaphysics of philosophy, mostly Kantian, and the Kantian philosophy is based on earlier philosophy, which I've talked about in the past, I'm not going to today. And then that was written into mathematics and physics by using logical principles. The same thing has to be dedicated to biological systems. And I'm trying to do that, and that's why I call it a dialectical event ontology. So a dialectical event means we can say, well, let's look at part A and part B and try to determine how A and B interact to generate a synthetic C, right? So it's a dialectic, but it's a dialectic within an event, right? And the event is hundreds and hundreds of billions of dielectrical interactions, right? And that's the true ontology of living systems. And so, okay, 20 minutes into the lecture, just to give you a reason why I go into this kind of depth. And you don't need the reason so much as you need me to do it with correctly and with the evidence behind it by using the primary peer-reviewed published literature. So we're not making huge inductions and putting it into textbooks. That's one of the reasons I use this format of using podcasts and sometimes video of lectures, because this is where I can really give you that understanding, because I can communicate with the language that's used to understand hierarchical responses in non-static systems. And whenever you're talking about biological systems, you talk about non-stasis. In fact, far from equilibrium, right? I've said that many times. Okay, so now let's take away from all of that prolegomena, and let's start talking about macrophages. We know what macrophages do. They're part of the innate immune response. What exactly do they do? They surveil and often reside in multiple organ systems. So they are interactive to surveil and search out for potential aberrations in cellular biochemistry, and also to search out for any potential invading pathogens or noxious compounds. So macrophages have to recognize a pattern of events. Again, a pattern isn't something fixed because it's changing with time. But in order to recognize a pattern, such as a lock, the key has to have a pattern to fit into the lock. So macrophages have to use molecular networks to pick the lock of what they're surveilling. And they're surveilling is non-homeostatic events. And they have to be able to surveil it without reaching a conclusion as a macrophage to destroy a cell lineage and mount an inflammatory response when there was no good biological reason to do that. So cells don't reason, but cells follow logical principles. And the reason they do is because humans who describe what cells do work under the network or the lens of logical argumentation, right? So when we describe phenomena in biochemistry, we're using our mind as a tool to disambiguate some small aspect of nature, right? And so obviously we talk about macrophages being able to find patterns. And the patterns we have discovered is there are, when macrophages are involved in the microorganism or the pathogen detection, they're dealing with pathogen-associated molecular patterns. And those are called PAMPs. And the reason that functions because we have a specific polypeptide organization called TLRs or toll-like receptors that are usually on the surface of membranes, sometimes endomembranes, and sometimes the plasma membrane. So subsequent to that recognition of a molecular pattern via the toll-like receptors, that recognition will initiate a process of elimination of the pathogen by engulfing it, and we call it phagocytosis, and at the same time, induction of gene expression to synthesize polypeptides that are glycosylated and otherwise covalently modified to be secreted. And those proteins are antimicrobial molecules. Now, if they're not proteins, they can also be inorganic compounds like reactive oxygen. And if we're not talking about reactive oxygen, like hydroxyl anion, and we're not talking about glycosylated polypeptides like cytokines, We can even talk about eicosanoids, oxygenated, preformed, very long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids. And then we can start talking about the molecular structure of those, right? Where are their double bonds and how does the double bond structure affect the function of that signaling molecule being utilized in the macrophage system to seek out and eliminate a potential pathogen, okay? So macrophages will simultaneously produce and secrete a host of cytokines, which are specifically pro-inflammatory glycosylated proteins, which will initiate an inflammasomal response. I'm going to talk about inflammasomes later. And also chemokines, which are also secreted proteins. And chemokines generate a biochemical gradient, for example, in the vascular system, so that other cells can detect concentration gradients in the vasculature, in circulation, and then be alerted to, and then alter their course of movement so that they end up obtaining the environment that generated the highest concentration of that gradient. So chemokines can cause cells, like immune cells, to alert, stop, and then change their trajectory, change their telos, and find the source of that alarm system. And that alarm system are the chemokines and the gradient generated therein. And macrophages are doing all of this. Okay, and that's just one innate immune cell lineage that is in circulation. Monocyte macrophages, or monocyte particularly in circulation. But macrophages also, because of diapedesis, can move in and out of cellular beds. And we've talked a lot about this, right? We spent a lot of time on this, actually. And so, plus there are macrophages that are resident in tissues, resident in the liver, resident in the kidney, resident in the central nervous system. Those macrophages we call microglia, remember? So they're still doing the same thing as the circulating macrophages, except they're doing it without mobilization, okay? But they're functioning in that same way. And so these cytokines and chemokines then recruit and activate other immune cells. What kind? Oh, other innate immune cells, for example, neutrophils, but also cells of the adaptive immune system. And those would include T lymphocytes and B lymphocytes and natural killer cells. And then a combined immune system will then organize around to eliminate the threat, okay? So I realize I'm out of time, just about, I only got about a minute or so left. So I'm going to stop there, even though I spent 20 minutes giving you another general overview type of lecture. The reason I'm doing that, and that was ad hoc, right? I have material in front of me, but I wasn't reading from anything when I was giving you that ad hoc open mic lecture, is because that's what I would be doing in an open lecture hall. I want to get you as a class, the Authentic Biochemistry audience. You can go back and listen to this as many times as you want to, if you can put up with my voice. But I want to get you inured into understanding how this is an event ontology and how pathology and normal physiology are interacting constantly. And so you can't really describe a pure pathological state in a system or a pure normal physiological state, because normal physiology includes components of the immune system which can be potentially dangerous, therefore can quickly become pathological or pathogenic. I want you to keep that in mind right now, just for the macrophages. Let's just center on the macrophages. I promise the next lecture, no induction discussion. I'm going to go right into the macrophages, okay? All right, this is Dr. Dan Guerra, and this was lecture number 10. It's supposed to be a membrane biochemistry on the morning of the 2nd of July, 2022. And of course, as usual, I would say bye for now.